This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today, Tonga struggles to manage the influx of returnees who've been deported from Australia, New Zealand and the United States.
If these people have no family ties, have no family land, are isolated and stigmatised, and they've got really good skills in terms of criminal activity, then of course they're going to go back to what they know.
For more on that story and also coming up...
It's totally sinful to give up part of any garden, let alone one that is historical and iconic, and it even can be regarded sacred for development.
We're going to take a look at why there's opposition to plans in Fiji to rezone the Suva Botanical Gardens so a new Indian High Commission can be built there. That story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beat. Good morning, I'm Catherine Graham. First, though, political leaders in Papua New Guinea are claiming that loopholes in the country's legal system and also inefficient police work are leading to the wrongful discharge of some high-profile cases. Last week, a court in the Southern Highlands province cleared 14 men of charges related to riots in the town of Mendi last year. There was also concern about the stalling of an investigation into the storming of the National Parliament by police and corrections officers late last year. There are incidents that have drawn the ire of several senior members of the government. For more on this, I'm joined by Pacific Beat reporter Nick Fogarty. Nick, where does this unhappiness stem from?
Well, as you touched on last week, the Mount Hagen District Court magistrate discharged a case against 14 men who'd been charged with arson, rioting, trespass and threatening and assaulting aircraft crew. These charges were all related to the day in June last year when a mob torched various properties, including an Air New Guinea plane and the home of Governor William Powie, because they were unhappy with the dismissal of an election petition filed by a losing candidate. Even though the prosecution called 74 witnesses, defence lawyer Matthew Tamatai filed a submission to dismiss the case on the grounds of insufficient evidence, and Magistrate Betty Jacob upheld it and the men were cleared.
Well, Nick, it was a very high-profile incident at the time and it caused a huge disturbance in the province. What's been the reaction to this case being discharged?
On social media, there's been a mixed reaction from the public, with some people expressing the opinion that poor work by the investigators had led to the lack of justice for victims, while others said they were happy the court had done its job. The Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, has now spoken out as well, telling local media he's confident there is enough evidence and that, quote, we cannot allow this kind of behaviour to go unpunished. Also of this opinion is the Police Minister, Jelta Wong, and he told me he's written to the Police Commissioner requesting that the case be reopened. Here's what he told me.
We have the evidence. The reason these men were released was through a little loophole within the investigation. And this loophole should not have happened, so I've advised the commissioner to relook at the investigation and try to satisfy the courts. The incident is a national incident. The burning of the plane is it's like burning of a flag in our country. It's our national carrier. What they did is wrong. They must be brought to justice.
So you don't think it's perhaps inappropriate to be interfering in the matters of the courts?
It's just my own personal opinion with the matters of the courts. You know, everybody can question the decision. Courts are made human, you know. People make mistakes.
That's PNG's Police Minister, Jelta Wong, and he went on to say that there really needs to be an overhaul of the way these police investigators are trained. While we were speaking, he also expressed unhappiness at delays in the investigation into police and corrections officers who stormed Parliament last November, saying that's been held up by legal technicalities as well.
Well, do you have any specifics on these loopholes that Minister Wong's mentioned and how they led to the clearing of the Mendi 14?
Yes, well, I also spoke to the defence lawyer for the 14 men, Matthew Tamatai, and he took me through the submission he made to the court. Essentially, he argued that none of the 74 witnesses actually saw any of the 14 men committing the offences they were accused of, and along with that, two of the witnesses actually claimed to be accomplices, which Matthew Tamatai says put further doubt in the court's mind that the evidence was valid. He told me he was confident that the judge would see the strength in his client's case.
It's really up to the police to do a post-mortem of their manner of gathering evidence and see whether they have done a job. If they were just there to achieve something within a certain time just to please the political masters, then they may have not done a good job.
That's defence lawyer for the Mendi 14, Matthew Tamatai, and he says, quote, really doesn't know if the state has any more evidence against his clients, given the length the investigation has already taken. We'll continue to watch those two cases closely.
Thank you. That's our Pacific Beat reporter, Nick Fogarty, there. Well, traditional landowners in Solomon Islands capital Honiara are upset that this week's groundbreaking ceremony for the highly anticipated undersea internet cable, which has been predominantly funded by Australia, they're upset that that groundbreaking was held despite no agreements being signed with them for the use of their land. The Tundai landowners, who own the customary foreshore area where the submarine cable will pass through, say they feel disrespected by the Solomon Islands government. Paramount Chief Charles Keku says that a memorandum of understanding has been discussed but not yet signed, despite Tuesday's groundbreaking ceremony, which took place while Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne was in the country. Our reporter Evan Wasuk is covering the story for us and joins us now. Evan, this Coral Sea cable will bring fast internet to the Solomon Islands by the end of this year, they're forecasting. But why are landowners not happy with this week's groundbreaking ceremony?
Catherine, the groundbreaking ceremony was supposed to mark a major milestone in the project with the start of the groundwork on the network hub, and it coincided with a visit by Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister, Maurice Payne. Australia, as you may be aware, is funding the majority costs of the project that will also see the undersea cable connect PNG to. The total cost has been estimated at around $130 million. So this week's groundbreaking ceremony was meant to celebrate the progress in the project. But the traditional landowners of the area around Honiara, where the cable will be going through, are not happy about it. I spoke to the Paramount Chief of the Tundai House of Chiefs, Charles Keku, just a short while ago. Now, he represents five main villages around the capital, Honiara. He says they were not consulted about the groundbreaking, and although a memorandum of understanding between the tribe had been discussed, it was never signed.
At this point of time, Baba Mifal no signing any MOU, because Mifala no doing any, or got no inviting Mifala lo any good round table discussion, and Mifala stood aware lo what is the project come about, and who are the people who own this project, and Mifala must have too what nam benefit shares lo Mifala inside lo this project.
Well, that is Paramount Chief Charles Keku there, and he was saying, Evan, as you mentioned, that they haven't yet signed the MOU, and in fact he said they haven't been invited to any sort of roundtable conversation to get a better understanding of what this project will entail. Land issues are often tricky in Melanesia, Evan, and Solomon Islands is certainly not an exception to this, but surely dealing with land ownership issues was something that the government and the developers of this project had factored in and should have already dealt with.
That's right. At the start of the project, the issue of land was highlighted as one of the risk factors. Since last year, there's been negotiations taking place between the government and landowners for the use of their land for the landing sites. When the issue was raised by the media, the PM and the government have reassured the public that negotiations were on track. Not only are we talking about the Honiara site, but also the provincial site as well, where the cables will connect the towns of Auki in Malaita province, Noro in the Western Province, and Taro in Choiseul Province. On Tuesday, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Rick Ho told ABC that he was happy with the progress of talks with landowners, and he was confident that the memorandum of understanding would be reached later this month.
I think we are making progress in terms of the MOU signing. We targeted for 15th of this month. We will be on target with that one. MOE signing for all the land landing sites also in Lohia, along with foreshore Lohia, as well as Auki, Noro and Taro.
That is the caretaker Solomon Islands Prime Minister Rick Ho there. Evan, so how will this issue be resolved?
Well, according to Chief Charles Keku, the Tundai Council of Chiefs want this to be resolved in the traditional custom way. In fact, he says they're quite happy about the project, but not in the way that they're being handled by the government.
Hem minim that because okata overlooking okata chiefs lo inside lo five tribe where okata stop inside lo Tandai catchment area, and then lo custom lo mifala time you not respecting somebody, you have to throw a chupu and consists of Kaikai and Pikpiki and Shell Money and Selene Blowit Money.
Well, that was Chief Keku saying that since the five tribes of Tandai have been overlooked, he expects the problem to be resolved in a traditional way with a chupu, which is a traditional ceremony involving pigs, shell money, and cash. So we've put in requests for follow-up information from the Prime Minister's office, as well as the Australian government, which is the major funder of this project. This is a developing story, so as we get more information, we'll update on it as more information comes to hand.
All right, thank you. That's our reporter Evan Wasuka with that story there. Well, Tonga is struggling to manage the influx of returnees deported from Australia, New Zealand and the United States. A steady stream of convicted criminals have been sent to the Pacific nation, despite many having almost no connection to their nominal homeland. Once there, they say they're being offered little support and some are falling back into crime. The issue is the subject of a new documentary, which is to be released later tonight. Here's Bill Bainbridge with more.
Got arrested since I was a juvenile. They tried to give me life, but I ended up going off with 4 years. By that time, they were telling me I was getting deported. I was like, okay, yeah, only Mexicans get deported. They're like, yeah, no, you get deported too. I was like, huh?
Ila Mwanga is back in his homeland, farming the family plot. But after living most of his life in Hawaii, he remains an outsider in Tonga.
I had people tell me they're scared of me and they don't even know who I am. And I'm like, why are you scared? They said, because you're a deportee.
Exact figures for the number of deportees are hard to come by, but it's estimated there are between 700 and 1,000 living in Tonga. In the past decade, more than 250 people have been deported from Australia alone. Most are men in their 20s and 30s who've been jailed for crimes like assault, theft or drug offences. Typically, they've been out of the country for more than 20 years. They arrive in handcuffs, their passports are cancelled, and then they're essentially left to fend for themselves.
Here in Tonga, you're just dumped at the airport.
Sione Molly was born in Perth, where his father was studying. He returned to Tonga as a five-year-old, then the family moved to New Zealand when he was an adolescent. There, he became involved in crime and was sent to jail, where he says he turned his life around. But now he says he's trapped in limbo with his family, including a wife and small children, still in New Zealand.
It's pretty hard trying to make something over here when you're pretty much foreign to everything you do. Yeah, you're home, you're Tongan, but what do you know about Tongan, really?
New Zealand filmmaker Ursula Williams produced and directed the film Gangsters in Paradise. She says for some deportees, the experience of being forcibly returned to Tonga is a positive one, where they reconnect with their culture and disconnect from the influences that drew them into crime in the first place. But others fall back into drugs and violence.
If these people have no family ties, have no family land, are isolated and stigmatized, and they've got really good skills in terms of criminal activity, then of course they're going to, you know, go back to what they know in terms of earning money and connect themselves with their international contacts that they already have.
Tonga is working on a national deportation strategy, but police and government did not respond to requests to explain the strategy or what's being done in the meantime. Ursula Williams says Tonga shouldn't have to bear the burden alone, saying Australia, the US and New Zealand are simply washing their hands of the deportees.
I don't think that they are acting responsibly. I mean, in lots of instances, these people have been byproducts of a society that isn't Tonga. So, for example, a lot of the crimes and things like that or criminal behaviour has started far away from in the US, in Australia and in New Zealand. And so they've created these communities and made these decisions in a completely different country. And countries that are first world and that have the resources potentially to actually rehabilitate some of the behaviours.
American deportee Sione Nagawe warns if more isn't done to help those being sent back, they'll not only damage their own lives, but they'll do damage to Tonga as well.
And those are the guys that I feel like that when they get here, they should have something that they can get involved in real quick. If not, they're going to become their own selves again and end up back in prison or making Tonga worse.
That is an excerpt from the film Gangsters in Paradise, ending that report from Bill Bainbridge. And if you do want to have a watch of that, you can find it online from this evening. Perhaps just try and search for Vice and Zealandia into your search engine to find it.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We head now to Fiji, where opposition is brewing in the country's capital to the government's plan to allow a diplomatic mission to be built on land that forms part of Suva's botanical gardens. The land has been gifted to India to build its high commission, and the local council is now in the process of rezoning the area so that construction can go ahead. But some locals are opposed to the move, saying such a culturally and historically significant site should be protected. Here's more from Liam Fox.
Suva's botanical gardens are an oasis of peace and tranquility amid the hustle and bustle of city life. Officially named Thurston Gardens, they were first established in 1881 and also house the Fiji Museum. Not only are the gardens a popular spot for locals and tourists alike, but Nicholas Holter, lecturer in history at the University of the South Pacific, says they are a significant historical site as well.
And that was the original village site of the Suva people. It was a site of European influence, intertribal conflict, and eventually the Italkay community there were relocated to Suvavo, just outside Suva, to make way first for the Polynesia Company, which was expanding its plantations, and eventually for the urban Suva city.
But the quiet of the gardens could soon be replaced by the din of construction noise. In a recent newspaper advertisement, the Suva City Council announced that the town planning scheme had been amended and that part of the land forming the Botanic Gardens had been rezoned from recreation space to special use embassy. The Fiji government foreshadowed the move back in 2014 after a visit by India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The then Foreign Minister told Parliament that the land, covering about 1.6 acres, had been given to the government of India for a high commission and a residence. In return, India had given Fiji around 93 acres of land in Delhi.
It's totally sinful to give up part of any garden, let alone one that is historical and iconic, and it even can be regarded sacred, for development. So that's the basic reason why I am in total opposition to this.
Opposition MP Nico Nawakula has started a petition protesting the rezoning. He says the public should have been consulted before the government told India it could have the land. Mr. Nawakula is not the only one concerned by the rezoning. Plenty of others have voiced their opposition on social media as well. The City Council has given people a month to lodge written objections. Mr. Nawakula doesn't expect the council will change course, but he says community opposition will continue nevertheless.
The plan is that if, which we expect, they will refuse it, we can take them to court, apply to court for a judicial review, and we might even ask the native owners to take a legal action by themselves, you know, for a declaration that that land belongs to them. There's also a chance we might have a march.
Meanwhile, historian Nicholas Holter hopes that at the very least, more people will become aware of the significance of the botanical gardens.
I think it is surprising that such an important historical location doesn't have much information about the site. I'd certainly like to see more information being publicly displayed that talks about why this site is so important to Indigenous Fijians, as well as just to the community today. It's a really important site for all Fijians to enjoy.
That is Nicholas Holter. He's a lecturer in history at the University of the South Pacific, ending that report from Liam Fox. There are more than 100 languages within the Pacific region that are considered to be at risk, and some could even be lost forever within just 5 years, it's predicted. But in some good news, some communities are working to revive their languages, and there's been renewed interest in the issue this year in general because it's the UN's Year of Indigenous Languages. Jordan Fennell reports.
Garayagna Waltanga, Yamuna Monara, Embulina Marasa, Yamuna Monara. That's the sound of a story being told in Nisarian, a severely endangered language found on the islands of Vanuatu. Just five people remain who can speak it. Right around the Pacific, there are dozens of languages at risk of being lost. John McCaffrey, an education researcher at the University of Auckland, believes a lot of it has to do with the push to learn English.
So even though the kind of colonial powers left the Pacific, the attitudes and values that local languages were good only for family and church and useless for business or development or education has continued. So, you know, well, I think it's true to say there's not a single country in the Pacific which runs its elementary primary education system and literacy in its own language.
He says this has made development in the Pacific difficult.
And so when people wonder why the Pacific is undeveloped and why there are so many issues, that's one of them. It's hard to gain a great deal of technical understanding and knowledge and skill if it's all conducted in a language that you neither understand nor speak.
This loss of language is happening rapidly, with estimations the languages from the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau face intergenerational extinction within the next 5 years. But not all hope is lost in order to regain some of those languages. In South Australia, the indigenous Kaurna language, which has been dormant for 150 years, has been brought back into use thanks to records kept by missionaries who visited the tribe back in the 1860s. Nick Tiberger, an associate professor of languages at the University of Melbourne, explains.
They've got to the point where there are very few speakers or no speakers, and they need to go back to find early sources and then try and figure out from those early sources what the language was like and bring it back so that it can deal with new terms and all those kinds of things.
Mr. Tiberger is also the director of Paradisic, a project which aims to collect world languages and archive those materials on the internet.
One of the main motivations for what we're doing is to get these materials digitised, put them online and publicise the fact that they're there for those communities. And we're doing that, trying to make sure that people out there in the Pacific know that these recordings are there. And every now and then we get these very nice messages from people saying, you know, that they've listened to their grandfather or their great-grandmother or some other relative that they never knew had been recorded. So that's the kind of outcome we want. And then this can also be used to support language programs that are out there. So in some places people are reviving languages or they're using materials to support language programs in various ways.
The Pacific nation of Niue has a population of just 1,600 people, but over 20,000 Niueans live on New Zealand. The mass migration means the younger generations are no longer really speaking their language or practicing their culture. The latest New Zealand census data says only 8% of New Zealand-born Niue school-aged children are able to speak Niuean. Tammy Kingi-Falakoa co-founded the Niue Youth Network, a community helping New Zealand-born Niueans reconnect with their language and heritage.
You know, it's nice to sit at home and be like, oh, I really want to know the language, but there's no one at home who knows the language. You've really got to get involved and be proactive about your engagement in the community and with elders and with grandparents.
She says she's seen an increase in young people taking up the language.
I feel like everyone's taking a little bit more of a proactive, you know, take on language revival and engagement even. There have been an increase of newer language classes held in Auckland. And that's not because of us, but, you know, our group was quite strong in having a presence and having a voice that is from young people to encourage other young people.
The University of Auckland's John McCaffrey says teaching the younger generations their mother tongue, both in the home and at school, is important to keep it alive. He warns if policies aren't put in place for this to happen, the consequences could be dire.
A language carries not just a kind of communication, can I buy an ice cream or a loaf of bread? It carries the values, the stories, the traditions, and the culture of a people. And so the entire Pacific history and heritage is at risk.
That's John McCaffrey from the University of Auckland. Jordan Fennell, the reporter there. Well, that's all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget we're also on air in the afternoons as well with Richard Hewitt joining you from 3 p.m. PNG time. That's currently 4 o'clock in Fiji, for example. And don't forget we're also online as well, perhaps Facebook, Radio Australia, in your feed.